Hello, Here and Now podcast listeners. It's Robin Young. With a favor to ask, please go to hereandnow.org/survey, all one word, and tell us more about yourself. Our survey takes less than 5 minutes, and your feedback will help us improve the podcast. So go to hereandnow.org/survey and answer a few questions. That's hereandnow.org/survey. Thank you.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The British Parliament is about to vote on whether it wants Britain to leave the European Union this month with no deal. The deadline for Brexit is March 29th. That is just 16 days from now. Yesterday, lawmakers rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's latest plan for a cleaner Brexit. She says today she'll vote against a no deal Brexit.
I want to leave the European Union with a good deal. I believe we have a good deal. Yes, no deal is better than a bad deal, but I want have been working for us to leave on the 29th of March and leave with a good deal.
You can hear she's been doing a lot of negotiating, losing her voice there. Joining us now is BBC political correspondent Nemi Grimley in London. Nemi, what are the expectations for this vote today on leaving without a deal?
Well, this vote today is slightly more straightforward than the vote on Tuesday night, in that it's widely expected that MPs will join ranks across the party divide to say that they don't want Britain to crash out of the EU without any arrangements put in place to cushion the economic blow. Now, there will be a rump of MPs, mainly in the governing Conservative Party, but also some in the main opposition Labour Party, who say that they don't mind if Britain crashes out. But on the whole, it's recognised that in Parliament, nobody wants to see this happen because they're worried about an economic shock to Britain. They're worried about what it might do to consumers, to jobs, and they'd rather not go there, to be frank.
Well, so they know they don't want that. They know that they don't want the deal that Theresa May put forth to exit with a deal. And then the next step would be what? To just vote on whether to delay that March 29th deadline.
Yeah, well, you kind of put your finger on the nub of the problem, because it's not really clear what Parliament does want to see happen.
Right.
So far, we know what they don't want to see happening, but there's no real sense of direction about what kind of Brexit they want. And that is really, it has been the problem for the last 2 years. You're right in that the next logical step, if they say they don't want to abruptly crash out of the EU, the next step is, well, do we want to go back to the EU and ask for more time to try and get our ducks in the row? And that is becoming much more likely. Again, widely expected that Parliament will suggest to Theresa May that she does just that. Then she'll have to have a discussion with the EU and say, well, how long an extension should we have? Would it just be a couple of months, or is something longer needed? And of course, that's a difficult conversation for her to have, partly because in the past she said we don't need any more time, and secondly, because all 27 EU member states have to agree that an extension is necessary.
But if that extension were to come, is the fear on the part of the hardcore Brexiteers that would open up the possibility of another referendum for Britain, and that the people would have another vote on whether they really want a Brexit?
Well, again, it would depend how long the extension was. If the extension was just until May, in other words, another couple of months, well, frankly, there isn't time to organise a second referendum in that time frame. On the other hand, if it's a year we're talking, well, then obviously that would be the kind of timescale where potentially a second referendum could happen. A second referendum is now the official policy, in theory, of the Labour Party, although they have their own internal disagreements about whether that's a sensible thing to hold or not. And it is now becoming more likely, in that even Theresa May has countenanced that if the deadlock continues, it's one of the possible options to trying to solve this sort of gridlock.
And I was talking to a British friend the other day, who said that he believes if there is a second referendum, that Brexit would win in an even bigger margin than it did before.
Well, one of the uncertainties is that, the vote was unpredictable last time. It could be unpredictable again. Mm-hmm. Also, many commentators and politicians are slightly worried that Britain has become this kind of nation infected by a culture war. People actually use the same phrase that you use in the US, mm-hmm. a culture war between left and right. And there are several people who worry that this might have, real serious effects on community cohesion, on the ability of politicians to just govern the country normally. So a lot of people, even though they might in theory like the idea of a second referendum, they're worried about the consequences. They're worried about putting the British people through this sort of turmoil again. There are also some people who argue that it would be undemocratic to ask the British people what they want back in June of 2016, and then to sort of ask the question again, just 3 years later. On the other hand, some people say, well, the facts have clearly changed mm-hmm. in the intervening 2 to 3 years. So asking the people whether they want to rubber stamp the exit properly is a good idea.
That is the BBC's political correspondent, Nemi Grimley, joining us from London on a very big week when it comes to Brexit. Nemi, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, from politics in the UK, we turn to politics here at home, where there's something unusual going on. President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi agree on something, that the president should not be impeached, Pelosi added, at least for the time being. The president tweeted today that he greatly appreciates Pelosi's statement and wrote, "Everyone must remember the minor fact that I did nothing wrong." Earlier this week, the Democratic House Speaker Pelosi told the Washington Post that she's not for impeachment right now, saying the Republican president is just not worth it unless there's overwhelming support for a removal from office. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back. In the president's tweets today, he claimed again that his first 2 years in office have been the most successful 2 years in history, and asked how anyone with such a record could be removed from office when impeachment is for high crimes and misdemeanors. What's your take on what the president is saying about impeachment?
Well, not everyone would agree with his record, so we can start with that. But even if his record is agreed to be successful, that has nothing to do with impeachment. President Richard Nixon was very successful. He brokered open relations with China. He negotiated an arms agreement with the Soviet Union. He was reelected in a huge landslide in 1972, yet his fate was to resign. So this is about whether a president committed high crimes and misdemeanors, not about how successful they've been on other fronts.
All right. So everybody's waiting for the Mueller report to come out. What would have to be in that report to reach the level of high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, I think it will either have to point to the president committing a crime as president, as opposed to earlier in his career and lifetime, and it will also have to show abuse of power. And that could range from abusing power as a candidate, which is a flimsier argument in some ways, to his doing something as president to obstruct the investigation or to, reward benefits that came during the election from collusion with Russia.
You say it would have to be something that he did as president. How about something as he was campaigning for president?
Well, I think they'd still, for the Mueller report to stick, it would have to then connect to what he's done as president. So I think for the political wins to shift, it would have to be that this happened during the campaign, and then we can see in foreign policy, for example, how that impacted what the president did. If the bar is to convince Republicans to switch their position, it's going to be a very high bar at this point.
So you're talking a lot about a legal standard here. We are looking at what various people in various parties are saying, also what the public is saying. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has supported impeachment in the past, and she told reporters that it should never be taken completely off the table. Do you see a coherent Democratic strategy on this issue of impeachment? And is there ever a coherent strategy on this issue?
Well, there's a division right now on whether he deserves to be impeached, for sure. But a lot of Democrats do support a congressional investigation. We have not had that. In Watergate, we had a full congressional investigation in 1973 before a formal impeachment process began. The Republicans have obstructed any kind of investigation, and I think even Speaker Pelosi supports the multiple investigations taking place. That's how you determine if a president needs to be impeached. You can't start with that question and answer it if Congress hasn't looked into it. So I think that's where Democrats are, and they can withstand the tensions over what the outcome's going
to
be.
So they have to reach a certain level, in a legal level, but what impact does public sentiment have in this?
It will matter only in that Democrats are going to be reluctant to move forward, especially since we're 2 years to an election, without any sense that this won't backlash against them. Many Democrats remember the late 1990s. They're thinking of Bill Clinton's impeachment when the Republicans in Congress suffered the political consequences. But they need to remember that in the case of Nixon, it was very different. And Democrats certainly withstood going through this process when it was the right process. It's about what the substance is. It's not only about the politics. That's how Democrats need to think about this.
Julian, since you're a historian, as you look back in history, I wonder if you can tell us what the danger is in a back and forth about impeachment and whether or not it possibly damages the work of a president, just as the debate is going on.
It does. Obviously, it's a distraction for a president. It consumes a lot of political capital. But Congress has an obligation to do this. The danger is really that because of all these political calculations, impeachment's just taken off the table. And that's as irresponsible as going right to impeachment as a default position, because presidents have to be held accountable for what they do.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He is also co-author with Kevin Cruz of the new book Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Thank you, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
Come, traveler. Discover one of the world's most fascinating cities, with its incredible skyscrapers and bold modern design.
Any guesses which city that promotional video is talking about? If you guess Chicago, you're right. A city famous for its architecture, its impressive modern skyscrapers, and its stunning historic structures. But if you visit Chicago these days to gaze at it all, you're likely to end up at the Bean. That's what most people call Cloud Gate, a sculpture by Anish Kapoor that's a favorite spot for tourists taking selfies because its mirrored surface reflects you and the stately skyscrapers that line Millennium Park. I stopped by the Bean with Blair Kamen. He's the Chicago Tribune's Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic. I asked him what he sees when he looks at the Bean.
I see possibility. I see contemporary technology used to make art. I see the clouds drawn down into this jelly bean-like polished mirrored surface thing where you can almost touch them. I just see wonder, and I see a new emblem of Chicago.
And a mix of old and new in this view that we're looking at right here.
It's an amazing thing. It looks lighter than air, but it weighs 110 tons. It has a steel armature inside, but it's got this polished, smooth surface. It's a funhouse mirror because of these complex curves, and it's perfect for Chicago because it's placed right at the foot of the skyline, and so it reflects the kind of great architectural achievements of the city, but in a way that you've never seen them before, because of the way that they're torqued and curved and, you know, reflected here. You see a picture of the city's, you know, drive, its ambition. It's reaching for something beyond the ordinary. And that's what this sculpture does. It's kind of, you know, it's been said it's like liquid mercury.
Yeah, it looks
frozen,
like it, right.
Right? But I think this has become, Millennium Park, this park that we're standing in, has become a kind of new town square of Chicago. And I think that's really important because this is a city and a metropolitan area that's often divided along lines of race and class. And yet this is an area where people can come together and coexist, at least in the same public space.
There's a word that I saw in many of your columns, and that is democratic.
Yeah.
This is very democratic.
It's not the traditional public sculpture, the general on horseback. the, you know, the great white man up on the pedestal. This is down on the ground. It's participatory. There's another public sculpture here that consists of two tall glass block towers called the Crown Fountain, and it broadcast digitally the faces of 1,000 Chicagoans. So in other words, and they're like 30 feet high. And in other words, it doesn't celebrate, you know, the great man. It celebrates ordinary people. These are the people of the city. The public sculpture here is interactive, it's democratic, and you just see that in the way that it's kind of acted as a kind of magnet for people in the city, for tourists. It's a different type of architecture and public art.
And it's relatively new, like a number of the other buildings that Blair Kamen says stand out in Chicago's skyline. We asked him to pick four. You can see them at hereandnow.org. He started with the Aqua Tower, which opened in 2009.
The Aqua Tower is interesting because it, first of all, it's designed by a woman, Janie Gang, and it departs from the kind of macho, muscular expression that's typical of Chicago, the expression of structure, the underlying steel frame of a building. Aqua's about curves. Mm-hmm. It has this very sensuous series of balconies that kind of wrap around it. And it's almost like built topography. It was actually inspired by some of the limestone formations along the Mississippi River and other places in the Midwestern region.
That's a departure from the tradition of modern architecture that made Chicago famous. For that, Kamen says it's hard to find a better example than the John Hancock Center, now known as 875 North Michigan Avenue.
The Hancock is just the essence of Chicago. If you imagine, it's a truncated obelisk, so it doesn't go up straight. It goes up 100 stories, and it tapers inward as it rises. It's not just the shape, though. It's in Chicago, there's a tradition of expressing the underlying structure of a building. And the Hancock does that just with great elegance and strength. The building is has a series of X braces that express the internal structure of this tube, a series of columns, X braces, and beams that hold the building up. By building the building in that way, by creating this tube structure, they saved an enormous amount of money over a conventional steel frame skyscraper. It's kind of like what resulted from that was it went from reason into romance, and it created this tremendous image, kind of dark, muscular. Like I've compared it to a Prohibition era gangster wearing a tuxedo. It kind of is vaguely threatening, but it's a great symbol of the city. And it's very different from New York, I should say. In other words, again, this is the Midwestern version of Metropolis. You know, if you want to look at New York, you know, you look at the Chrysler Building. It's kind of jazzy and fun and pizzazz. And we have Art Deco, great Art Deco skyscrapers too, but you know, Chicago is sober and tough and serious, and there's a blue collar aspect to it, and that's the Hancock.
Blair Kamen's next pick wouldn't be described as blue collar. It's the only high rise that was allowed to be built east of Lakeshore Drive. Lake Point Tower has a curved form that stands out, as the architect George Shipperite noted.
The Y-shaped configuration for the tower gives each resident a view of Lake Michigan. The 120-degree angle between the legs of the Y minimizes the ability to see into someone else's apartment.
Blair Kamen says those curves go against the right angles that typify Daniel Burnham's 1909 plan of Chicago.
And fortunately, the only skyscraper east of Lakeshore Drive, because the whole idea here is that the lakefront, as Burnham said, by right, belongs to the people. And, I mean, that's one of the great things about Chicago, the democracy, the democratic impulse of its architecture. That architecture isn't simply for kings, princes, the traditional patrons who built churches or palaces. The palaces here are parks for people or shopping centers, department stores like Louis Sullivan's Carson Perry Scott store. That's an ideal, of course, but at its best, Chicago is an expression of American democracy in three-dimensional form.
probably puts a premium on the condos in the Lake Point Tower that it's the only one east of Lakeshore Drive.
Yeah, it does. Although it's interesting, if you've been in those condos, they only have 8-foot ceilings. They're kind of low by contemporary standards. But nonetheless, when there's the air and water show here, people in Lake Point Tower see that they can literally see the eyes of the pilots as they fly by in their jets.
The two tallest buildings in Chicago didn't make Blair Kamen's list: the Willis Tower, formerly known as the Sears Tower, and the Trump Tower, which opened in 2009. The Trump Tower sits along the Chicago River near the last building Kamen wanted to talk about, which has been around for nearly 100 years. That would be the Tribune Tower.
The Tribune Tower is another great individual Chicago building. It's this neo-Gothic skyscraper that was based on French Gothic cathedrals of the medieval period. It soars up from its site near the Chicago River. It has flying buttresses. It has grotesques. Those are gargoyle-like sculptures that signify the importance of freedom of the press. It has this Gothic crown that kind of stands out beautifully alongside the clock tower of the Wrigley Building. The other special thing about it is that it has fragments of famous buildings from around the country and the world embedded in its base. The publisher and editor of the Tribune, Colonel Robert McCormick, in the 1920s, ordered his correspondents to obtain, by, quote, honorable means only, pieces of famous buildings. So there's a piece of the Vatican, the Parthenon, the Great Wall of China. Cultural appropriation? Probably. But it does create a kind of vicarious around-the-world tour that, you know, tourists love to see. It stops tourists in their tracks, and they see these fragments.
Those fragments are still there, but the Tribune staff moved out last year. The building will be turned into what else? Condos. And if you think of things the way Blair Kamen does, just imagine the Tribune Tower is a person starting a new job.
When you see these buildings, yeah, it sounds like you see people.
Oh,
the buildings absolutely are people.
Well, the buildings exemplify the spirit, the energy, the ambition, the drive, the aspirations of the city. That's why I think people care about them so much. You know, they speak of this, you know, what was as recently as, less than 200 years ago, this flat, barren, nothing settlement, essentially. And, you know, all of a sudden it's been transformed into this incredible global city.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who want you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Canada is the latest country to close its airspace to all the Boeing 737 MAX jets. That includes models 8 and 9. The MAX 8 was involved in the Ethiopian Airlines crash over the weekend and a Lion Air crash last year. But the planes continue to fly in the United States. Joining us now is NPR's David Shaper. And David, first, what do you make of the news from the Canadian Transport Minister who cited new information? Do we know what that information is?
Well, yeah, it appears Canada was one of the last holdouts with the U.S. in refusing to ground the Boeing 737 MAX planes. And the new information appears to be some satellite data that was referenced in some reports. That's not totally conclusive, but there was also a statement by a spokesman for Ethiopian Airlines today as they continue to participate in the investigation of that crash Sunday, that suggested that the pilot struggled to maintain control of the plane, that there were no external factors like a bird strike or something like that that was affecting the plane. And that's similar to what appears to have happened in that Lion Air crash back in October. So that information appears to be what's prodding the Canadian Transport Ministry to ban these planes from the airspace. And that's a big deal because that's our northern border. We share airspace with them. So it's possible that some U.S. flights or flights into Canada from the U.S. could be affected.
Does that increase the pressure on the U.S. to follow suit, even by virtue of the geography?
I think it does, because we had been an island, and again, we share a border, so we're cut off a little bit. But the FAA has been insisting all along that these planes are safe and that they've had no information showing any sort of systemic performance issues. And in a statement last night, they said there's no basis to order the grounding of this aircraft yet, and they haven't seen any other country provide data that would warrant such an action. We'll have to see if that posture now changes.
So NPR has learned that a number of U.S. pilots who fly the Boeing 737 MAX planes have complained about the planes in a federal database. A couple have reported the automated system pushing the plane's nose down. They were able to eventually right the plane. But this problem may be more widespread than we know. And apparently Boeing is working on a fix for the software, believed to be a factor in the Lion Air crash, and potentially this one as well. As you said, we don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it part of the issue, though, that the pilots were not told about the software?
Right. Well, one thing that pilots complained about right after the Lion Air crash is that they were not made aware of this new automated flight control system that essentially takes over if a sensor thinks that the plane is about to go into a stall, meaning it's pitched too high and might stall, and then it'll point the nose down. Now, what appears to may have happened with that Lion Air jet is that there is a faulty sensor giving erroneous information and acting on that. That's why the system pointed the plane down. But if pilots don't know about it and don't know what's happening, it could catch them off guard. They may not have the tools or the training to right the aircraft. And that appears to have happened a couple of times, but the pilots report being able to regain control by switching off the system. It's really kind of complicated because, you know, a lot of pilots are saying right now, those for Southwest and American Airlines, that they still have confidence, even after the Canadian government's action here today, in this aircraft and flying it, that they now have the information and training that they need to keep this plane flying safe.
NPR's David Shaper speaking with us. Thank you very much, David.
My pleasure, Lisa.
New details are emerging about what federal officials are calling the country's largest college admissions scandal ever. At least 50 people are being charged in the scheme, among them college team coaches, parents, exam administrators, and the brokers who accepted hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars to place kids in elite schools. Now, it may not be a surprise to many that the playing field for college acceptance is uneven. What is surprising is the level of corruption on the part of the middlemen, coaches, test administrators, and brokers. Also notable, of course, are the parents, who are willing to pay millions for a spot for their kids at prestigious schools. Let's bring in two people familiar with the admissions process. Dave Marcus, a private admissions coach and the author of the book Acceptance. He's in Washington. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
And we're joined also by Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois, my high school. Hi, Lisa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let me just start by asking each of you whether you were surprised by this. Dave, you first.
Jeremy, I was surprised by the audacity of this scheme, but I was not surprised by the sentiment behind it. There's so many kids who are under so much pressure. I've dealt with many parents who actually offered to pay me extra to write the kids' essays, to completely write kids' essays. And I've given speeches in that very area recently in Newport Beach, California, where parents asked me, how much do I need to pay a university? How much do I need to donate for a building to get my kid in?
Hmm. Lisa, what about you? Were you surprised?
No, I agree with Dave. I'm not surprised at all. I do think this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think that more of these type of behaviors are going to come out to the open. And again, this isn't always just a story about celebrity. I mean, the man who is now in the forefront of this fraudulent scheme was actually in Champaign-Urbana 4 years ago. So he seeped his way into central Illinois and basically preyed on families' fears.
Preyed on families' fears how?
Basically by talking about the elite schools and how his catchphrase, which was on his flyer that I saw 4 years ago, was, quote, getting into college is not a secret, it's a science. And if you actually know this process and you counsel from the heart and help kids be authentic, it isn't a science. It's an art. It's an art of building a class.
Dave, where do you think the problem stems from? Is this the parents who are just so eager to get their kids into these elite schools? Or is this the people who are making it possible, obviously illegally, for them to do that?
Jeremy, it's way beyond that. And I can speak to you as a parent of three, two of whom have gone through the college process. And I tell parents when I speak all over the country just to relax, to enjoy it, to make it about letting the kid discover who he or she is, help the kid figure out what dreams he or she has. And yet, as a parent, I have to tell you, you worry about your kids. Will they get good jobs? Will they find a way to find footing in this economy where you're not going to go work for one company for 20, 30, 40 years? So it's way beyond admissions. It's about the fears we have. And I sense it in middle-class communities just as much as wealthy communities.
What do you mean? That people would be willing to pay to get their kids in these middle-class communities?
Well, they'd like to. They asked me how to do it. But just the sense is that there's a ticket to success, and it's wrong. But the sense is if you go to one of the top 30, 40, 50 elite colleges in this country, mostly private, that's going to ensure your kid's future, and that's going to ensure good earnings. That's going to ensure being in a startup or being in a big corporation. It's not that simple at all. Their fears are exaggerated in some ways. But more important, they're doing all the wrong things by pressuring their kids, trying to game the system. But I do understand where it comes from.
Well, and Lisa, you've talked with us many times about the fact that there is an obsession in this country that is not healthy with
yes.
some of these elite schools, that it's not necessarily even the right fit for everybody to try to get into these, you know, very few schools, the Ivies, et cetera, that you know, there's a lot of places people can go to college and get a great education.
And Dave hit the nail on the head when he talked about there's now this belief system that there's some magic ticket to basically ensure happiness and a roadmap to success. And we see that seeping down into K-12 schools, that, again, you have to get into the right school to then get the ticket to the right college. And it just doesn't work that way. And when you talk with families about, look, this process is about self-reflection, depth of research, taking an honest inventory of who you are as a young person, they literally will often not want to do that work and find the easy route. And that entire concept of gaming the process, beating the system, how do I get privileged to basically be read in a certain way to get? There are no guarantees in this process. So I think what we try to help families understand, which I think is at the heart of this scandal right now, is Rick Singer was quoted as saying, quote, my parents wanted guarantees and I had to find them a side door. There are no guarantees, because there also is no guarantees to happiness and success.
But if I can interrupt,
yeah,
there is a guarantee we don't talk about. And the counselor I wrote about in my book, Acceptance, always tells parents it's not about where you get in. It's what you do with those 4 years. If you're curious, if you think, if you question, there is a guarantee of sorts, which is that you're going to be better qualified for this job market. And frankly, I'll throw in a pitch for what these parents didn't understand. The best thing you can do for many kids is have them take a gap year. Go work at a restaurant. Go have a real job. Go volunteer. Go study something obscure. Go travel if you can and live in another country and be part of that country. That's a guarantee that you'll be a better, successful person in many ways, not just in sort of what ticket you got.
I'm with you on gap years as somebody who took a gap year, by the way. But let me ask you this, though. It gets to the point of even if these kids did get in through the back door, they're not going to succeed in a school that they maybe wouldn't have been able to get into on their own, right, Lisa?
Well, and I think the saddest part of all of this is the fact that if these students truly, I know there's different layers to the scandal and whether or not kids knew about what was going on, why their parents and so forth, but what a sad testament or a belief system that parents had, that they felt like they had to basically manufacture their child to look better because they weren't good enough on their own accord to get in. So I think what I get so worried about is this misguided and dangerous tunnel vision that basically now has created this tier of schools will basically give you this. And as Dave mentioned, I mean, we talk constantly, Jeremy, about these kids just needing to grow and thrive somewhere, and that some schools that may not be on their radar are ones that they need to consider. But if I can tell you one theme that I'm seeing, I'm seeing families that are not coachable, are not teachable. I'm to the point where at some of my workshops, I just want to start with my intro and say, if you are here to learn how to get into the elite top tier schools that get all of the press and all the notoriety in U.S. news, please leave, because that is not what this talk is about. If you're here to learn about how to bring your authentic voice to this process and not manufacture yourself and push your children to do things that they don't genuinely connect to. That's the goal of this process. And I don't think a lot of families and students, because they're burned out, confused, tired, scared, have a misguided definition of the future, are like able to necessarily grab onto the fact that there are no guarantees based on GPA and test scores.
Dave, let me ask you, what do you think that this whole scandal has done to people's confidence in the system?
Well, the charges, the colleges themselves are not charged with wrongdoing, but it shows that the process, the admissions process, is fraught, is corrupt in many ways. And I use corrupt in a broad way because, look, parents have offered me huge amounts of money to basically get their kids into college. And in that, they don't ask me to take the tests. I'd be terrible at that. But they ask me to write essays. They ask me to coach the kids on interviews. They ask me to make some calls to admissions offices. This is so wrong. And what I've done in college coaching is wrong in a lot of ways, too. I try to do a lot of pro bono work. I try to basically tell students, as Lisa said, there's tens of thousands of colleges out there, and often the ones you haven't heard of, the ones that aren't the fancy ones, are the ones where you can really make a difference. So we have a huge problem in the admissions game that someone somehow has decided there are only a few acceptable colleges to get into. And we really should remember that colleges in this country are engines of social mobility. They're ways of people getting up the ladder from all incomes. And admissions has to be not about the money you have, not about the test prep you can afford, not about bribing coaches or even wowing admissions people with manufactured things and going to Nicaragua for 3 days and saying that you rebuilt a village. It's all about curiosity and learning and trying and striving and, as I said, questioning things.
That is Dave Marcus, private college admissions coach and author of the book Acceptance. We've also been speaking with Lisa Maselli, director of college counseling at University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, Illinois. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
President Trump's 2020 budget that was released by the White House Monday calls for a 12% cut in total funding to the Department of Health and Human Services. It includes nearly $300 million to, quote, defeat the HIV-AIDS epidemic in the United States. But funding for the program that fights HIV and AIDS overseas took a big hit. The U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR, was cut by about 22%. The president's budget is just a blueprint and will have to go through Congress. The Trump administration hopes to reduce the spread of HIV by 90% in the U.S. in a decade. A big part of the White House strategy is to get people into treatment quickly. Metro Atlanta is one of the country's HIV hotspots. Some groups there have been working to break down barriers that often keep the most vulnerable populations from getting care. Sam Whitehead from member station WABE reports.
Like any good millennial, Milan Randolph spends a lot of time on his phone. And when a little red notification bubble pops up, he likes to take care of it.
So if I see this, I'd be like, what's that in there? Then I go and I'm like, oh, I gotta take my medicine.
That medicine is called Biktarvy. Randolph takes it to reduce the amount of HIV in his blood. He tested positive for the virus in 2014 when he was in college.
I call HIV a mild inconvenience. If anything, I have to remember to take a pill every day, which, you know, often isn't really hard.
But that wasn't always the case. After he was diagnosed, it took Randolph an entire year to seek treatment for any number of reasons. For one, he didn't like the first questions he'd often get from providers.
Every time they would ask if I was gay, and that would always make me extremely uncomfortable because I had not yet accepted my sexuality, my identity.
Then, taking medication would mean accepting his HIV status, which was no small thing. Randolph also says he had trouble finding people to confide in.
I think we all need somebody, even if it's one person. And that first year, I had nobody. And it was really, really tough to fight that alone.
Enter Daniel Driffin. He's co-founder of a group called Thrive SS.
That's where we have invested interest, not only because we are Black gay men that went through the linkage process, but it's needed.
Thrive offers transportation and housing services. And Driffin says some 3,000 members across the Southeast turn to its online support group for advice on living with HIV. He pulls up a private Facebook page and reads a post about a specific drug.
I go back in 4 weeks to make sure it's working. Do anyone have any experiences on this pill? And literally 27 comments later, it's someone now reassured in the process.
Driffin says Thrive members also chat about bad experiences with healthcare providers.
I actively remember walking into medical appointments where my doctors did not look me in my eye, did not talk to me, they talked at me. That's a turnoff.
He says one uncomfortable moment can be enough to keep someone from seeking care. Olivia Chelko works with Positive Impact Health Centers, a Metro Atlanta HIV clinic. She says staff there try not to waste chances to engage with patients.
If we're providing medical care but missing those opportunities, we're not going to be successful with that patient.
Getting people into treatment rapidly is a major strategy of the Trump administration's HIV plan. At Positive Impact, that starts with testing, which happens in a small set of rooms just off the lobby.
So, you know, we have our educational materials out here, our condoms. We do the INSTI test, so the result is immediate. And these are just the tests.
If a test comes back positive, you can see a physician and leave with a prescription the same day, all without leaving the clinic.
I mean, we try to make sure there isn't a single barrier that might be preventing you from not only seeking a test, to seeking treatment, to getting your meds filled, but also after that, when you get home, becoming compliant.
This one-stop-shop approach is crucial to curbing HIV transmission in the Southeast. Here, stigma, racism, and poverty still keep people from seeking immediate treatment, says Wendy Armstrong. She's with Emory University and runs the Grady HIV Clinic in Midtown Atlanta.
It's a really important strategy because it is a way, I think, to show that the healthcare system is investing in an individual and saying we care about your health and it is important to control your virus immediately.
It may have taken Milan Randolph a full year to seek treatment for his HIV, but he's glad he finally did.
I've decided to live, and I've decided that to do that, I would take this medication. I would go see a doctor because I want to help curtail the virus as it impacts my community and impacts my state and my city.
Public health officials want a lot more folks to get to that same place. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says close to 40,000 new people receive HIV diagnoses each year. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.